This is the Topicus Track special interview with Larry Nemechek. I'm a doctor, not a con panelist.
Welcome to the Topic is Trek, the podcast that runs on impulse power. Join us for a journey where no show has gone before. If it has to do with Star Trek, there's a good chance we'll talk about it. Sooner or later, because on this show, the topic is Trek. Engage already.
Joining us now is Star Trek author, archivist, actor, consultant, and producer Larry Nemechek. Larry can trace his Trek roots back to growing up and going to school in Oklahoma, including founding a Star Trek club in East Central University. Over the years, Larry has worked on a whole host of Trek projects, including several Trek books, Star Trek The Next Generation Companion, and The Making of Star Trek First Contact, to name just two. He's also worked on displays seen in the queue of our beloved Las Vegas Star Trek The Experience attraction. Long live that attraction. Mm-hmm. Larry's favorite Star Trek character is Leonard McCoy, a passion that would eventually lead to a role, which we will surely talk about. And currently, in addition to everything else Larry is involved with, he's producing and directing The Con of Wrath, a documentary based on the infamous 1982 Ultimate Fantasy Convention in Houston, and, as if that weren't enough, he's the host of the new weekly Roddenberry Podcast Network show, The Trek Files. Again, topics we hope to touch in the next few minutes. Please welcome Dr. Trek himself, Larry Nemechek. Did we miss anything?
Wow. I was just impressed. Well, I would like to mention Portal 47, which is kind of like my dream baby for fandom and as a business. But I'm just impressed that you had those first nouns in alphabetical order or whatever. You had archivist, actor, whatever. What? Anteater. No, wait, that wasn't one.
Clinton wrote it. I just read it. Good on you.
I was very impressed. I don't think anybody's ever done that before. I've never done that before. That was great. No, it's good to be on, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having you. Thanks for being on the show. Let's talk about our first question. That's my curiosity. Will you be on the Star Trek Cruise 3 next January?
No plans yet. So that's that.
They're 60% sold out.
That's good.
It's better hurry.
I think they figured out that maybe two at a time was a little much after the first one was such a big hit. So, but I keep in touch with people that are going, and it'd be nice to go. Time I hear there's because start. You know, it's really funny. I mean, that's great. It's a huge, big licensed project. Mm-hmm. It's by a company that makes its bread and butter by licensing theme cruises. That's all they do, and they do a whole boat. It's funny to me, though, that there have been Star Trek cruises since the 80s. Back, I mean, Gene and Majel started on the first few. There were Sea Trek and I'm going to blank on them now. Anyway, there were two different companies that did cruises since the 80s, and a lot of the actors over the years have done them. But they were small. They were like a piece of a boat would be, because you never sold that much. But good on Cruise Trek for, or on the Star Trek official cruises for going whole hog from a company that can do that, you know, and they fill the boat. And but now there's a whole community of people that do that every year. So it's another thread in the tapestry of Star Trek.
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, all three of us are going. Clinton, cool. Chuck, and myself.
With our wives.
With or what?
Well, it's 20. You think the huge conventions or something, the cruises are 20. You're trapped. Everybody is, whether you want to be there or not, 24/7, you're on that boat.
That's why my wife insisted on a balcony. So when she wants to chill out, she can just go sit there.
These
contemplate jumping over the side, maybe. No, I'm kidding.
Hey, I wanted to talk to you. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I want to talk to you about Star Trek Continues. It's one of my favorite fan film type, you know, that spawned through the whole. Yeah, it was fantastic. I loved it. I wanted to get some of your thoughts on that now that it's finally, you know, closed up shop, which is unfortunate. I wish it could have gone for another 5 years, to be honest with you. But just want to get some of your thoughts on that. What was one of your, I know you were on what was it, two or three episodes?
Two at the beginning. Yeah, it's McCoy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, just what are your general thoughts about that, the whole thing?
Well, you know, it started off as a lark when, I mean, you know, Vic came to me 3 weeks before we filmed Pilgrim and said, would you like to play McCoy? I mean, I met Vic once, thanks to Ralph Miller, who's incredible independent sound designer, mixer, ADR guy, and a wicked sense of humor. Has done a lot of our bloopers and parody things and does a really crazy Nixon impersonation. I tell you what, if you're on YouTube, if you ever go to 1600, no, I'm sorry. Oh, if you go to 1701 Pennsylvania Avenue, there's a hysterical Nixon Star Trek crossover. Okay.
Okay.
Just putting all that right out there with Ralph. But Ralph is the one that introduced me to Vic. And then within 2 or 3 months, Chuck Huber wasn't going to be able to do the first few shows. Might not at all. And, on 3 weeks' notice, I said, Vic, I just know that what Kirk is to you, McCoy is to me. And, but still, I got there, blew me away. We had a crazy flight getting in. It was also the same month that I was already excited to be working on, and the world didn't know it. It was a big secret at the time, working on Stellar Cartography, the new map and book set that came out in 2013. And I was already thrilled to be doing that. And I was like, oh, I actually told Vic no at first, because I'm like, I can't let anything mess this up. I can't be slow or late or distracted.
Right.
And he was like begging me to, he took me a phone. And I was like, okay. He's like, we've got internet here. You can stay in touch. I'm like, okay. So I felt like I was, you know, and I think that first episode, if I look a little tired or whatever, I think it's because I was up at night working on Stellar Cartography and shooting during the day, but the right. whole group blew me away. I knew Lisa and Tim, our makeup designer and co-producers, and I knew Ralph, and I barely met Vic, and that's all in that whole family of incredible people, talented, creative, wonderful people from all over the country, kids to professionals. The only ones that I know when I walked in the door, and it was such an amazing. I mean, the bar was way higher than any other fan film project I'd been involved with, as far as being a tight group, even though it was early on. And then it only went up from there. So
yeah,
I had no idea at first it was just kind of an open-ended, let's see how this goes. But if I could have known how the impact it would have and what it would come to mean to so many people, and even how it crossed over, because, you know, a lot of the original series people are the biggest fans, but with Vic and Todd Hepburn and Chuck's anime audience, and the Comic-Con audience, but that anime crowd, a lot of the teenagers that had never seen Star Trek would come up at the conventions, and I was like, wow, we're getting Star Trek out to
yeah, starting a whole new
hungry broad audience. So I think, yeah, you know, that's one of the things that kind of kept us in official favor, mm-hmm, aside from just not breaking any rules. So yeah, it was an incredible time. I'll never forget the world premiere in Phoenix. We had like nearly 4,000 people in the house, and we signed posters for like 3 hours. That was insane.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So no, you know, I love it. And even after I wasn't playing McCoy, staying on as creative consultant and helping out and fixing some things and going out and document, I've got so much video and photography from the shoots that I was at. Yeah. I think there'll be little things like that dribbling out over the next few years.
Oh yeah. Like behind the scenes stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Oh cool.
Yes. I put a few of them out there. If you go to my YouTube channel, I've got some things from Continues out, some interviews. I've got interviews with some of our guest stars and some of the cast that I haven't put up yet, just getting around to it. But a lot of B-roll of a lot of folks just at work and scenes being shot and a lot of bloopery, goofy stuff when people go a little loopy.
Well, I got to tell you, the entire run is so consistent, you know, and it, of course, dovetails perfectly into the original series aesthetics that I was, there's a few times looking at Vic, I almost see, you know, Shatner and his original, Kirk, you know, I'm like, whoa, it's just kind of freaky, you know, the way everybody kind of blended in so well.
Yeah. I mean, it's always a new, you know, you go back and look at comments from the first, you know, from Pilgrim or from Lulani, and it takes a while. You either like it or you don't or whatever. It's everybody's got their own opinion. But at the beginning, everything new, speaking of discovery, everything new sometimes right. takes a while. Every new iteration, every new hiccup or every new you know, out of the box takes a while to get used to. But yes, most people, I think, really wound up cottoning to everybody, all the portrayals. I mean, the Phoenix world premiere, the thing that struck me is we were kind of getting used to the impact of Continues on people. Every fourth or fifth person would say, I feel like I'm a kid again, and I just came home after school and saw a new episode that I'd never seen before, mm-hmm. you know, or I've just found a lost episode. And,
right.
And that was, and after about, you know, 80 of those, I started thinking, wow, did anybody under 40 see this yet?
Right.
But that aside, and I know they did. I know lots of people have. But that aside, yeah, that's I think a lot of younger folks, is, and maybe even got more of an, it's just funny how the pendulum swings in Star Trek. I talk about a lot, and how, you know, in my lifetime, Star Trek, the original series went from being it to the old show with plywood and Christmas lights and right. hammy acting and bad special effects to being retro cool and being 60s, you know, and so it's kind of funny how the attitudes of all the shows change.
Yeah, you're right, because then the movies came in throughout the 80s, and that kind of changed things. And then you got the TNG. Everything's kind of coming.
TNG at its height, 60s, the 60s Trek was kind of, eh. You saw that in conventions. You saw that in merchandise. But then when Voyager and DS9 Enterprise had gone on for a while, people were starting to get a little tired. The fandom was dividing. Other things were distracting. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you were coming up on the anniversary years and, oh, this is so retro cool. That was the phrase. That was the buzzword. It's black and silver and retro cool. And
Which anniversary years are you talking about? Because I remember distinctly watching TNG and seeing the 25th anniversary moniker come up. And has it been that long?
I'm not going to do math if you don't force me.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about was by the time Enterprise was running and it wasn't doing as well in the ratings, and the time that the JJ crowd decided that the best way back to do a Star Trek movie was to go back to the roots, only not. I mean, go back to roots, which meant Kirk, Spock, McCoy and the original Enterprise, and then, you know, but not do the roots. So that's what I'm talking about. And, you know, and Next Gen, even at the time that was happening, Next Gen went from being the hot show with the movies to that 80. It's so 80s, with the carpet on the wall, the therapist on the bridge, and they're going to talk about everything. They're going to have
the captain's bald.
Yeah, they're gonna have a board of directors meeting before every decision. You know,
I'm not a committee.
On the committee. So now we're in the time of, you know, and DS9 went from the show that didn't go anywhere, you know, to now it's the series that has stood the test of time the most because they had serialized shows and it's dark and you know, so everything. You know, Doug Drexler even said there's been when we had the 12 years of what I call the fallow time with no series Trek.
Yeah.
Doug said a few years ago, you know, Enterprise. He said there's fans of Enterprise that are just now finding out he said there are fans of Enterprise out there that don't know they're supposed to hate the show.
Yeah.
And right now, I think the Kelvin fans and Discovery, we'll get into this, but I think I really want to, this year's my mission, I've been saying, is at the conventions, online, at anything I do, I want to meet and talk to people who are into Star Trek now, just from Discovery, people who are just coming to Star Trek. They're not fans of one of the older shows and just went and discovered because it was the new thing and they have their, you know, whatever they want to talk about, All Access or the show or Dark or touch screens or Klingons or, oh my God, I love it, I'm represented or whatever, you know, good, bad, it's all out there. But a lot of times that's colored by where you came from. And I just want to talk to them and a group that I think has never really been talked to much anyway, even after 10 years, is the whole half a generation that's come to Star Trek from the Kelvin movies, no matter what the rest of us thought about, you know? So anyway, because I think a lot of times we get blindsided. We have our blinders on, we go in our rut and 5-10 years go by and hey guys, some things have changed. Dynamics have changed out there. And you know,
this is your chance to step in Spock's role and do the reunification. Bring everybody together.
That was a deep cut. Well, I just kind of have that anyway. I've been doing that since I was like a kid, wherever, you know, work or college or school or whatever. So,
yeah, no, but that, I think that's intriguing. I would like to hear the perspective of somebody who is just getting into that discovery.
Yeah, because they don't, and I say baggage. I don't mean like anybody who's been a fan for 10 or 20 or 30 years has baggage, like it's some psychobabble thing.
No, but you've got colored perceptions.
You have the perception. And what's cool about Discovery is, and I talk about Discovery like the movies didn't exist, but they were movies. I mean, I don't mean to totally ignore the Kelvin movies. They weren't my choices, but I know they did a lot of good for the franchise. They brought a ton of people in. They got it back in mainstream conversation. The cast are excellently cast, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I wish a lot of people are mortified that Quentin Tarantino might be doing a movie. I'm actually, I think it'll either be the worst or the best Star Trek movie ever.
No, I am in that boat too. I'm like really excited, but at the same time, like kind of scared what's going to happen.
Cautiously optimistic. Yeah.
But the best thing is it's different now that there is a series. If this was 3 or 4 years ago, I would be mortified because the world is the non-Trek world. That, you know, the suits and the mainstream media and the bean counters, all the people that control Trek beyond fandom. I would be mortified if all they had to represent Star Trek in their mind was a movie every 2 years, much less what it was and who was doing it. But now that there's a series on that's really back where Star Trek belongs, and that's its first best destiny. I don't, it's like, fine, go do whatever you want to do with the movie. It won't matter if it bombs. It won't be the shiniest thing in the room. The shiny thing over here for the short attention span theater folks is there's a deep cut back to Saturday.
Yeah, yep.
sorry about that. But you know, it's like Discovery will still continue to hold. You know what I'm saying?
Kind of like Star Trek V was during TNG years. Like, yeah, well, that didn't work, but we're still going.
You know what's scary was I've never even thought about that, but that's pretty. That's true.
Call it a mulligan and keep going.
Yeah. Because there were a lot of original series. You know, we trying to give some context to people here this last year and a half, whatever you thought of Discovery, but just to point out, whenever a new iteration, especially after a long gap and a new group is in charge, after a long gap, it's gonna look different, it's gonna feel different. I mean, Wrath of Khan, you know, when they killed Spock, I had a lot of angst and bitterness and the marketing campaign that was going to boycott it. And Next Gen was that way. It's not Kirk, Spock, McCoy. How can you call it Star Trek?
Yeah, I was going to say that ties in perfectly with what you're digging out of the Trek files and, mm-hmm. and talking to people like DC Fontana, you know, what Dorothy has to say about that transition and how it worked for her. I'm totally digging what you're talking about on that show.
Oh, cool. Well, again, it's amazing. It's only 15 minutes. Me? 15 minutes. But yeah, so yeah, Rod came and said, we've got all these files of things of my dad's that aren't in what we've given to the UCLA archive yet. Let's do something with it, but put it out there and not just scan a document and put it out, but let's talk about them in context. Then and now, a gene level, a Trek level, and a, you know, media and culture level then and now. So that's kind of, I'm amazed that we get that in 15 minutes, but it's been a lot of fun.
So you and Rod are on first name basis and you just call each other up and say, hey, look what I found.
We tend to do it in work. We are on a first name basis, but we tend to like work in batches. Rod's a busy guy. He's all over the globe on things. So John Champion and I are kind of like the hands-on. John kind of is really kind of a producing director kind of thing. He was my guest on several of the shows from, you know, does Mission Log, but he is over there more, but it's all there. They have an office now and have for several years actually, but they just built a nice little studio to record podcasts and shows and things in. And we actually went through, and they had been, you know, for the 50th, they'd been scanning a lot of documents and posts and whole scripts and that kind of thing. But this is more, we have our share of memos and not scripts per se, but memos and pitches and writer's guides and that kind of thing, but also other people's, not so much from Gene also, but also things from people to Gene in whatever era, the 60s, mm-hmm. 70s, 80s. And sometimes it's just a single page. Like we had 2 months before he came on as a show when they were just getting to know each other, a letter from Rick Berman as a thank you note to Gene.
Yeah, I listened to that just recently. That was cool.
Yep. Oh, there's the face of the document. And again, sometimes they're a page, sometimes they're 12 or 15 pages, and it's all there for people to see along with to listen to the podcast. But sometimes it's just a great doorway, bigger topic or the beginning of a bigger topic.
Now, where do you get the guests for that show? How does that process work out?
It's me, all the people that I've known for the 20, 30 years and working, you know, editing the magazine and doing the companion and working front row with the Berman era and getting to know people now with Discovery, although Discovery is so hot, hot, hot. It's almost like there's a statute of limitations about they like the little spoilery, you know, type interview sessions. So we may not get to do deep dives with them. So some of the white hotness of the show goes away. But if we're talking, you know, if they're the meme that they did with some of the last round of Blu-ray audio commentaries on some of the movies, we're getting people who didn't work, who from other ends of Trek or later generations of Trek. Like I got to do one of those with Ira. I asked Ira if he'd do it with me on Star Trek VI. So neither one of us had anything really to do with Star Trek VI, but it was fun to, you know, talk about it. And they've done that. So we may have some newer folk talk about some of these historic pieces, but it's basically who may be a good match. And my thing with this, just as it's always been with when I had the Communicator magazine, when I do Portal 47 now, is I like to get folks from the series, from the shows, or just a next door, you know, affiliated project, especially folks who haven't been heard much of, or we think we've heard them, but we haven't, you know, and pin them down to whatever this thing is about right now. So yeah, so having Dorothy on was good. And John, but also Dave Rossi. And I've got two more coming. We're about to do another batch of shows, and having a 15-minute show is great because then we can do four or five, a guest comes over. We've done them all live. I'll probably have to know at least one will be Skyped in, but even then we'll probably do four or five, you know, segments, four or five shows. So people can, it's dribbled in across the schedule a little longer. Like we had two with Dorothy. There's one more coming up for now and we'll have her back hopefully. But yeah, it's just who I thought would, it's a match of who we thought would work well with a topic or be a fresh take on it or who was there. And also folks that deserve to be heard more and maybe haven't been.
So I think you kind of answered a minute ago, but so the material that you get for the show, you don't go like through the archives yourself and go, oh, this is interesting.
Dumpster diving.
Well, actually it's different. So they have a person on staff that's been going through papers, getting things in order. And a lot of times he'll go, oh, I bet Larry would like this. Oh, I bet, you know, sometimes he pulls things out for John and Ken and says, I bet they would like that. But that we had one session where several people came over to help Rod and Trevor with the office files, old things like this. And we did go through them. And I found some things on my own. The show we did about the memo from David Gerald to Gene when they were brainstorming for Next Generation in 86. And David, he was using a Vulcan to say it, but David was saying we should analyze some of our, you know, our memes and tropes and make sure we're not becoming a stereotype of ourselves. It means one thing to us to go to a new planet and say, we come in peace.
Yeah.
What do we do if that planet says, only the people who really mean war are the people who say we come in peace?
Yeah.
Well, that was exactly the rest of Discovery.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right. The Klingon, right. You know, the Klingon nationalists. So
that was brilliant. And what a foreshadowing.
And it's not, there's no way. That's not, nobody on Discovery was digging through 30-year-old memories.
Right.
86. Right. But that's in the, it's partly in the DNA. It's partly common sense, but it's also in the DNA. It's in the water. And so being alert for those, and 2 years ago, I wouldn't have thought that at all about that. I would have read that and went, oh, okay. Yeah.
But nice.
Yeah, it rang again. So that's part of what we're doing is looking for things that are great little historical nuggets for everybody that knows at the time or newer fans that just want to know something historical, but finding those pieces resonate still, or they're really about and that's what Rod wanted us to do is find a foundational touchstone in the first, especially the first episode. We talked about the believability factor that was all the way back in the first original series writer's guide. Those touchstones, it's just in the DNA of Star Trek. So when we get off talking about what production or what a different shift in culture or whatever is doing to the show, to the different, you know, iterations as the years go by, what is the DNA of Star Trek? What are the foundational elements that make it Star Trek and not just some sci-fi? And people, you know, debate that all the time. And people have their pros and cons and critique movies and series. But that was right out of it was a horse's mouth. And it was just scary how that particular one echoed around. It seemed like a perfect example of that.
If you find a piece of paper that talks about traveling to different dimensions on some sort of spore network, I'm calling time travel.
Yeah.
Someone is planting things for you, Larry.
I see. Yeah. What's his name? Matt Winston's the actor. I've gone blank on his name. The temporal agent in Enterprise.
Yeah.
I can think of the actor, not the character name. Daniels. There we go.
Yes.
I didn't want anybody calling in. Oh, wait, we can't call in.
Yeah, we're safe.
Yeah, they're leaving breadcrumbs or spore crumbs. One of the two. Guys, I know I've been doing some really deep, deep, deep hardcore research, and I found, are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They did a show about spores on the original series.
You're right. Well, are you talking about
the one where they were breathing in on the planet? Yes.
Spock, yeah. Nothing says Star Trek like Spock swinging from a tree.
That's right. Smiling Spock.
Yep. And of course, it was all set up by the spore show that Enterprise did. We were laughing about that one day, but there's actually been a spore show on every series. We just weren't attuned to it. So,
oh my! You mentioned Portal 47. Let's dive in there a little bit more.
Well, that's a good word. That's what I call our. So Portal 47 is the Star Trek that I always wanted to do and share and you know have as a business. But that was something that brought something to Star Trek. My thrill of hosting the Trek Files is I didn't want to do a podcast until I figured out, and I have a couple of other ideas, but I wanted to add something new and fresh to what's out there. There are so many good podcasts, present company included.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I wanted a fresh angle. I didn't want to do some, you know, just add on more because there are frankly some out there that, bless their hearts, there's more of the same. And I love to support all the podcasters, just like I love to support all of fan fandom. But I didn't want to just throw on the pile. Mm-hmm. And I think Trek Files is that way. And it's the same way in a bigger sense, because I knew these, you talk about how I get guests. Well, I've been, you know, fortunate, very appreciative since I came out here naive and wild-eyed and had no idea how the world worked in Trek or in Hollywood, really, in 94 or 92, actually, when I was working on the TNG Companion, and learned so much and was, you know, myself hopefully honest and trustworthy. Not I was no Boy Scout, but but, you know, made my way that way and built up relationships with so many of the people that worked, especially in the Berman years, but back into the original series folks and the movies and hopefully now through some of the Kelvin movies and into Discovery. And I just knew the famous names, you know, like, well, you can't forget the actors. I just say, forget the actors. You can't forget them. We love them. They're charismatic. But if you really want to know what goes into the show you love, or if you really have a question, it used to happen to me all the time at conventions. There'd be Jonathan Frakes or somebody be on stage and somebody'd say, ask questions. And he'd say, you know what? That's a Herman Zimmerman question, or that's a Michael Westmore question.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, why aren't they on stage?
Right.
Yeah. Because I knew me and would go to that con and it would fail, but I would have fun. Well, I know that's thanks to the internet and social media. We have a little bit broader reach now, but that's what Portal 47, I say Portal 47 is we use the tools of the 21st century to go backstage, you know, and behind the scenes of all the starships and sound stages from the 21st, 23rd, 24th centuries. And it's like a mini con every year, all month long. There's 9 points in the month at max. And we have some live touches. If I'm at a convention where we have members or deep divers or the portales, as I call them. And it's kind of like a new, without getting too crazy, it's like a new wave fandom that fills in the gaps of where even conventions and podcasts and, you know, magazines and interviews, you can only get so much Star Trek out there. And what's frustrating to me is I say Portal 47 is for old fans, new fans, bored fans, and fans who have no idea how much Star Trek they still have no idea about. And a lot of it is going backstage with a lot of the folks that worked on the shows, because they talk about what they do, their own memories, whatever, whether they're a stunt person or they're an assistant in the writer's room or they're a prop person or they're visual effects or their art department or they're a writer, producer or whatever, or they're a freelancer who sold three or four stories or whatever. It's all those angles and perspectives because they talk about themselves and what they did, but also the folks that they worked with. And so we keep hearing angles. And a lot of these people involved are no longer around. They can't speak for themselves, especially original series. I found a woman that was she's wonderful. She was the ladies' second and third, the women's second and third season costumer on the original series.
Oh, wow.
Worked with Bill Dice. So she's talking about all the original series crew folks and remembering them and a lot of these folks have their own photos. So it's photos you've never seen. And we do slideshows while we're talking. So, and the guest spot is like the highlight of the month, but we have roundtable and I share documents out of my archives and they get sneak peeks on my videos before I put them up. And my little Trekland trunk, when I put something from archive, I scan and I'm trying to get rid of the bulk. So I'm getting rid of a lot of paper and things and just putting it on eBay. But before I do, I photograph it or scan it and put them up. And if you're in Portal 47, you get it like a discount if you're the winning bidder or whatever. But so there's little pieces. I have a day tour now that I do called Trekland Tours, kind of a mini, doesn't compete with the big Geek Nation Tours Star Trek tour that we do every 2 or 3 years that we're doing again in 2019 before the Vegas convention. But I just have a day tour that you pick from a menu and come out and do that. And if you're a member, you get a discount on that. So, but it's the live shows I think people do, and they get a recording. So if it's the guest and me talking on camera, or if it's just audio, it's like a conference call on a business thing. Only instead of being boring, hopefully, it's the most exciting, fun stuff that's ever been done on a conference call software. So that's Portal 47. It really is like a mini con all year long. And it's portal47.net. I invited everybody to go. I have specials. I've been having an open house, virtual open house, where everybody come on and we have a big guest. I did the first year I had Robert Butler, who was director of The Cage.
Oh, wow.
Who? Yes, exactly.
Wow. Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And he's like in his 80s and he's still good to – it was great. And the second year I had David Livingston, so who was there at the beginning of Next Gen and all the way through, wound up being the most prolific. He directed 10% of all the Berman era – he was – all the Berman era shows. He was the biggest director on DS9, did the most hours.
10%?
Stories there these guys could tell.
I know. And so cramming. Usually we don't do an hour. We usually creep into an hour and a half with almost everybody. But they're just, we just have a lot of fun. And sometimes there's just jaw-dropping stories. So between them talking about what they do, which is interesting, and there's at least one or two moments every time when people are, oh my God, and I'm watching chat room because it's just me and them talking, but everyone's listening live and everybody, and we have the slideshow going by, so we have photos and we bip around too, and I like to watch the chat room, people going oh my God or wow, and now I wish I'd been because I've been doing this for over 2 years, I wish I'd been cataloging these better now. Someday I'm gonna have to go back and transcribe these and pull out the really cool bits. But so it's Portal 47 is for 10, 15 years, I was wondering what the next, the digital revolution and dead tree media was going away, and there was no Star Trek active, and I was debating whether I should just go sell some shoes or, what I should do with my life, and I had so many people go, all that Star Trek stuff and the things you have and the people you should do something with that, and I'm like, well, what? And they're like, I don't know, And the world, and there was, and people said, oh, you should do something cool with the internet. And I'm like, well, what? Well, I don't know.
Do something cool with the internet. Entertain me, monkey.
Right. I would love a Star Trek monkey. A little hurdy-gurdy sit on the sidewalk. But, hey, monkey, now do Bob Justman. Okay.
Was he by Robert Picardo?
Fake mustache. Yeah. Or a Picardo fake mustache. So, hey, but that's why I'm really, it's a lot of work. It's really been, the hardest thing about it has been getting, like, I've been sitting here blabbing for 30 minutes and you still have no idea what I'm talking about. But the hardest thing is getting across the concept to people. But I have a really good bunch of, we're, of over 50 members and climbing, and it's set up where I can do, over 100 in there. And I have a premium level now called Deck One that's everything but just more of it. Mm-hmm. So that's been exciting to build that. But it's been like a whole new, I don't know of anything in any fandom that's like what I'm trying to do with Portal 47. So we just basically we say Portal 47 where no savvy fan has gone before and and then let people find out.
Yeah.
I had a thought as you were talking about the costume lady that you talked to. And it was one of those commercials. We salute you, TNG second and third season costume lady. You brought collars to the Star Trek uniforms and improved the cuts so they don't look like a unitard.
You make it so.
She really did improve the costumes. You got to admit that over the first season.
Well, just to back up. Her name is Andrea Weaver, so she's a real person. And we're talking the original series, not Next Gen.
Oh, wow. You went way back.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying.
In TNG, that's when everybody got the collars. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's when it improved. And
she wasn't designed. I mean, Bill Tice was the original designer. And I think you're talking about when Bob Blackman came as a designer to Next Gen. And brought the, yeah, got them out of the spandex. You know, Bill Tice started with the spandex, and they gave them all backaches.
We still salute you, young lady. Was it a green shirt or a gold shirt? Oh,
she has her notebook. You laugh about this. We all do. We have to. I was going to say this.
I had to poke the dragon. Notebook,
and she has her thing that says, you know, like engineering red, sciences blue, command green. That's what her, you know, she has the swatches in her book. I did a camera interview. She was a guest on Portal 47, but I went over to her place and to her home, and we did a camera interview that I've got, I need to do something with sometime. It was just amazing, amazing. And I made sure and had her talk about all those, some, you know, 90% of them have passed now, but I wanted her to talk about people up and down the crew because they were such a tight little, all the Star Trek, you know, production crews are tight, but in the 60s, you know, they didn't have eight writers. They had two or three.
Small, yeah.
I loved your dive into the writer's guide and explaining how that came about. That was because we all assumed that, you know, the writers just go in and they know the show and they know the characters. And no. They were getting like contractors and people from out of the industry. That was fascinating.
Well, it is. Well, that's what everything I tried. That's what I enjoy doing. Now, I was really weird when I was first a fan, went to my first convention. I was so excited because I'd read about the New York conventions, you know, in the LAs, and here it is, the Midwest. And I went to OCON, and I had a box, and I put here's graphic detail. It was the box because we never threw anything away. It was the box that my turntable of my stereo came in, okay, because it was big and square. And I loaded it up with all of my background books, right? So I had the Tech Manual, Medical Reference and Concordance. I had The Making of Star Trek.
Yep.
I had some of the Best of Trek magazine background books in there. I had all that stuff piled in because that's what you do at a convention, right? A Trek convention. You go and you sit around and talk about background, right? Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Well, no, that's not what anybody did. And if they're sitting around talking, they're probably talking about the characters. I'm like, well, yeah, okay, the characters, they're good because that's why they're good. That's why it's a cool show. Now, let's get to the really tough stuff. It's like, oh, I didn't get it. Oh, that's why zines are so popular. Oh, fan fiction. Oh,
it hurts when they call you a nerd.
I found out that I wasn't quite the most common stripe of trek, but it's better than in the stamp and, you know, in the self-addressed stamped envelope days, better than thinking, you know, you write one letter in one magazine and then six people from around the country write you and you go, great, me and six other people. That's all this matters to. And now, you know, thanks to the internet, maybe it's you and 600 people or 6,000. But no, we have, you know, now I say the canonistas and the tech heads and the ship nerds and all of that. And it's all good. Everything's good. It wouldn't be Star Trek. That's why Star Trek, the folks who are, not to jump into Discovery, but, and we can talk about this later, but I think.
Not to sport jump into Discovery.
No. Did anyone say Black Alert? Maybe Blackout Alert, but not Black Alert. I think that's the last year. I mean, the fallow years and then the coming of Discovery and all the debate and talk about it as the visuals came out. It's really, it's good because it makes you stop and go back and think, you know, re-examine. The one thing I got out of grad school was about always remember to re-examine your assumptions.
Yes.
Which is the fancy way of saying, you know, watch out to have those blinders on and don't. Yep. don't get hit deer in the, don't be a deer in the headlights. And again, nobody thinks exactly the same way you do. Don't assume the whole world thinks the way you do.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can learn something from other people, and or maybe you want to fight for your way to the death, but at least don't sit there and be shocked that other people might have a different take on things than you do.
Yeah, that shock is over for me. I've seen it so many times.
Thanks to the internet. Speaking of conventions, give us a bit of history about the Houston convention and what that led to.
Oh, okay. Well, that was a, yeah. So you're talking about my documentary, The Wrath of Khan, and The Khan of Wrath.
Oh, yeah, I didn't want to correct you on that one.
Wow. Oh, I wish. All
he's
that money's
moving the Wrath of Khan.
35 years later, and the money is still showing up. That's amazing. The Khan of Wrath is the title of the document I've been working on in the last year or two. People are going, Larry, when are you going to finish this thing? And we're there. But it was always going to be like a shade tree project, you know, kind of on the side. But we are wrapping it up. But it's really about this real live event, June 1982 in Houston, 2 weeks after the Wrath of Khan, for real, mm-hmm. Star Trek II opened. And it was basically the biggest, I say it was the rock show for Star Trek. There had only been, quote unquote, Star Trek conventions, which are today's huge Comic-Cons, by the way. It was the first time, you know, a single franchise and the personalities on screen with that were the dominant feature of a fandom event. So, you know, there had been sci-fi conventions before that were about writers and artists. And to be fair, before media was easily known or expended or whatever, that's what science fiction was. That was the main channel of science fiction, right? So, and that had been around for 50 years, the early world cons and the early local conventions. But in the 70s, Star Trek was the first big media explosion, and there were separate Star Trek conventions, so they wouldn't keep, you know, drowning out the poor, you know, sci-fi guys and gals at the lit cons. But that had only been, like, the first big one was the first famous one in New York in 72. It only been 10 years. So fandom and conventions were this wild west, this group of events. And it was a crazy time, a lot of colorful personalities. But anyway, a group in Houston that had done conventions, and Houston had had a local convention, Houston Con, since the 60s, but was also nostalgia and westerns and old time radio and all kinds of things mixed in.
Okay.
But the group that had been doing that and other conventions decided to do, and led by a guy named Jerry Willhite, decided to do this really visionary, let's not just do a convention, let's do basically an arena show. Let's let our beloved cast, A, get them all together for the first time, and B, do a talk show with all of them. Let Nichelle sing with an orchestra. Let's do Walter can write a one-act play, and we'll do that. And it was really the first time anybody had tried anything that like that. And they got Starlog, before the internet, Starlog magazine was the Bible of media sci-fi.
Yeah.
You found out, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And how I found out was the full page ads in Starlog. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And it was just down in Houston, which was 8-10 hours away by car. So I got into it, went down. I was actually there, two of my buddies, my brother, little brother. And what happened to us happened to everybody. They had the entire original cast, aside from Nimoy, which in itself is a story in itself.
Yep.
And at this arena show, they did three shows in the Summit Arena, which is where the Houston Rockets used to play. It's where all the traveling, you know, rock acts and musicals and things would play. And it's still there. It's now Joel Osteen's megachurch, who were very nice to us and let us film in there, actually, several times. They were wonderful to us. But basically, back in 82, the reason The Ultimate Fantasy is not the title most people remember this whole event by is because things did not quite go as they were planned. And by the end of the weekend, The Ultimate Fantasy was being called The Ultimate Fallacy, The Ultimate F-Up, The Ultimate... Yeah, and one intrepid person, you know, again, 2 weeks after the movie had opened, said, no, you guys, we just survived the Khan of Wrath. And button makers in the dealer's room heard him say that, and there are now, and I have been privileged to have been given, two original versions of 1982 I Survived the Khan of Wrath buttons.
Cool.
So yeah, we did. We only stayed one day and left. And, you know, flash forward, you know, years and years, years later. And about 8 years ago, I was at a party, heard a guy talking about Houston and the Con of Wrath and Ultimate Fantasy. And I went, I said, you were there. You were there. And he goes, I was the tech director on the stage. And I just had a light bulb off. And I was like, I've been wanting to do a media project and not just be a word guy. And I thought in my brain, I was like, I can do this. And they told me that most of the original organizers were still in Houston. And I thought, I can do this. This needs to be preserved. I can get this on camera, not just on, you know, on mm-hmm. tape. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, oh my God, this could be a documentary. And I thought, yeah, if we keep it to Houston, and I knew Walter and Harv Bennett would talk to me, and probably Nichelle and George at least. Because, you know, Jimmy and Dee were gone by then. But and that's basically how it grew. I said, I'm not going to put any pressure on this. I'm just going to do a little bit of time and grow it. And we'll see what happens. And that's exactly what happens. And they've been amazing. I did the last camera interview of Harv Bennett. He died about 4 years after I talked to him. He was awesome. And Walter, both of them, I said, if they won't talk to me, they were kind of the ringleaders of organizing and then not organizing the actors and then calming the waters as things melted down.
Right.
And I thought, if they will both do it with me, then I will do it. If neither one of them will go, or if I only have one of them, then it's off. And they both basically said, oh, you know, not just yeah, but hell yeah. And because they vividly remembered bits of it and the weekend. So we were off and running. And I've got so many more people than I've got survivors, I call them, across the country that were attendees and survivors. Dealers. And well, you know, I survived.
Yeah.
So we have dealers, and we've got Harv, you know, like great Harv Bennett. But I've got Walter and Nichelle and George, and working on some of the rest. I have Laura Banks, who was one of Khan's blondes, the one that actually fired the button that killed Spock, the one that had a line. She was at the weekend. Who else? Well, a lot of folks that were there. Some of them, like Eric Stillwell, my good friend Eric, who wound up in fandom and then worked on It's Star Trek at Paramount, was a fan then. Publisher of Starlog, who wound up getting roped in to be the MC, wrote his columns at the front for years in the magazine. He's on camera. But I talked to so many of the dealers that were there, because there was a whole meltdown and a pass the hat, and they were asking dealers to buy out the show. And I decided I could almost do another documentary. I want to call it Connie's instead of Carney's, because these guys have been on the con circuit.
Small hands smell like cabbage.
It's amazing, that whole world of the conventions, from the world of the guys who were on the circuit, right? And every week or two go to another convention, big or small.
Yep.
And some of them have been doing it for 20 years and 30 years. And I just thought that would be... Anyway, I've got some of them on camera talking about this weekend. So, no, it's... We just need to do... And along the way, not just the story of the weekend, but also I wanted to give younger fans, newer fans, a taste of... Here's fandom in the early 80s.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, before the cell phones, before the internet, it's like watching an old movie. This story is like watching an old movie and realizing 5 minutes in, if they just had a cell phone, the whole plot would have been pointless. Right?
Right.
But they didn't have, they had to go, you know, he couldn't even get to a payphone. So that's part of it. It's like how things have changed, but on the other hand, how things are exactly the same in fandom, in celebrities, in culture, in media. Mm-hmm. And that, and another sub-thread is I got really, I laughed at and also was angered by this thing about the geek girls, and the geek girl revolution is a recent thing. Like, there've always been women. Women were the original zine writers and editors who started organized Trek fandom that conventions came out of. And I wanted to show all the women that were involved in 1982. Oh my God, how could that be? You know?
Yeah.
So yeah. Basically, again, how things were so different, and yet how things of fans being snarky. Oh no, say it isn't.
What is the current status of the documentary?
We are in post.
Oh, do we have a target release date?
Well, we've had a couple of. I've been trying to get it wrapped up by the. What really, it's been more a case of the rest of the world keeps running in and snatching me up and not leaving me alone. First, it was, you know, continues. blew up my schedule a little bit and sucked up a year.
Thanks, Vic.
The 2 years. Yeah.
Then we got all these annoying podcasts.
All these annoying, but doing the Trek Files. Launching some of the other projects, it just takes a little bit of time and focus away. I'm doing it the first time. I've got some people that are wanting to help. I'm still, looking on the financing end of it, but now and setting sights a little higher the last few months. And sometimes the better things just take a little longer. So, I have a lot of good friends on my side helping me with this, and we'll see. And I have a couple more people maybe to get on camera. We'll see how that goes. But overall, yes, it's been long enough. See, Rod told you, remember Rod's documentary Trek Nation that he started and went on and went on and went on, and he had different editors and directors working on it. And I just remember when it wound up taking 8 years and it was finally out. It wound up going to TV. And they did a version with the commercial breaks and all that. And he just, I told him about this and he looked at me, goes, just don't take 8 years. We're bearing down on 8 years. So thinking of his
Rod, we did it in 7.5. Beat that. Yeah.
Well, there's the 40th anniversary coming up in a few years.
Right. But it's been amazing to get to know this bunch in Houston. And, people have gone on with their lives. Only one of them is still involved in active old school LitCon fandom, like WorldCon fandom. But everybody is a fan to some extent, and so many folks I've talked to, even around the country, and some crazy, wacky stories that are like little sidelights to the big story. It's just been great, and I really feel like I've gotten a lot on. It's given me a couple of ideas about doing something further once we do get this done. But just being able to preserve this moment in time and do this snapshot and, again, show how much things have changed. But again, how much everything is exactly the way, people in fandom or in celebrities are exactly the way. Nothing has changed on that, on the one hand.
Well, speaking of changes and new directions, before we go, I wanted to talk to you about Discovery.
That's such a transition, yeah.
How's that for a segue? Our show is not known for our segues. Or maybe it is known for the bad segues.
Yeah.
Speaking of life on Earth, and culture.
Right.
Speaking of oxygen.
So what do you think? I gather from some of your comments, you're not a fan of the Kelvin films as much as your other stuff.
Well, I just say I was frustrated at first with just the idea of the Kelvins. Although I'll say one thing, as the years have gone by and we've learned more about how that think tank was working, I will defend. A lot of people have jumped up on Alex Kurtzman and especially on Bob Orsi, and they're not they're not writing together as partners anymore. I hope eventually we can see what the script was going to be for the third movie that wound up being Beyond, which in a lot of ways I enjoyed the most of the three. But yeah. I just, the whole trope of going to an alternate universe to me was like, well, this is fine. At the time, I was really frustrated. I was impatient. I was like, look, guys, I'm going to die in another 40, 50 years, and I just want as much Star Trek crammed in as I can get before I'm gone. Mm-hmm. And to me, an alternate universe was like, well, these are like nice stories about fake people or fake stories about well-known people. It's like we can do this, but especially when there were no, now there's a comic book line that's kind of fleshing it out a little bit.
Oh,
but
yeah.
For the most part, it's like, this doesn't relate to anything. There's no impact. When we're doing Prime or we're debating Prime, as the case with Discovery, at least there's an impact and there's an immediacy to it and a connectedness to everything that's come before and all that. And sometimes people are disappointed or they're upset, but at least they're talking on that level. Mm-hmm. And it's like we were laughing a while ago, but it's like, oh, well, it's the alternate universe. Does it really matter? It's like,
unless someone can tie the two together.
Well, that would be crazy, wacky. Maybe that's what Quentin's up to. Maybe that's what Q-Trek is going to be. But you say Q-Trek and you get an image of John DeLancey, so I guess that's not going to determine it.
Yeah, Quentin's going to have the story where the Enterprise-C comes through a little temporal hole. And
stop.
And there's a Klingon war going on. Oh, wait, that's been done now.
Back to your thoughts on Discovery.
Yeah, Discovery. So, when they announced Brian, I was like, oh my God, they're actually going back to getting a Star Trek veteran to do the new show. And when they were announcing you know, Nick Meyer and, mm-hmm. and Joe Manosky and all of that. It was really exciting. And then just to see the reminded of the labor pains, as we were saying, especially when there's been a big gap, especially when a new crew is being put together to do it. Even it's not just one guy. It's you've got a whole production army that's got to put the right. show together. So it was interesting watching it unroll. I was a little, you know, as it turned out, I'm very much a little wincy about, and I get it, about creatives and the desire to do something new and the thought process that this is 2017 and it's supposed to be the Cage era, but we can't design it like it's 1964. A modern audience would not go for that. All and right. I say, well, you can design 64, but you can shoot and edit and cinematographize it for today. A little bit the way In a Mirror Darkly on Enterprise did with the original Enterprise set, right? Or the Defiant.
The Defiant, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that footage and you go back and watch an original series episode, they're way different. And there were a lot of tweaks in materials and graphics that they did. They had very slight motion in some of the panels and things. So the Klingons, I mean, but the bottom line is this is a CBS, this is a studio official driven series.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That the writers have done a pretty good job with, I will especially say, the fact that it went from Brian and then Brian's staff behind him to one by one Brian's staff turning over to, or that staff to the staff that eventually stayed over right. the course of a year and a half, which was insane.
Yep.
But it, only because it was Star Trek and only because it was launching a new business, right? I think if it had been anything else, they would have said, oh, problematic show, pull the plug. But this show had to land, and it had to launch All Access. And that's a whole side controversy with fans, I know. But that's the corporation. They're doing this just like they launched UPN with Voyager. So
it's a different form of syndication.
Well, right. And, you know, Star Trek, you've always paid for Star Trek. You may have just have paid a nickel more on the products that were sponsors on NBC or something or mm-hmm. the syndicated series or whatever. But, mm-hmm. You know, I try really hard. I remember when I was a kid and Next Generation came out. And I remember those original series people going, you can't call this Star Trek. Gene's betraying what he created. It's not Kirk's. How could it be Star Trek if there's no Kirk, Spock, McCoy in the Enterprise? And my immediate reaction was, shut up. I've never had new Star Trek. It's always been a rerun to me. Gene is running the thing. What more do you want? Just shut up, you know, or don't watch it. And those people, there are a lot of people that did not watch Next Generation out of original fandom.
Yeah.
But then the Next Generation numbers exploded and no one cared after a while.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And I just never wanted to be the grandpa on the lawn yelling at the kids about things. So I always, because eventually... What's going to happen is just like people griped about Wrath of Khan. I mean, I remember thinking that it was way too militaristic. It was, oh, this is just Reagan's conservative 80s with all the brass on the cuffs. This is not Gene Starfleet. But, you know, after 10 or 15 years, that all gets, to coin a phrase, it gets assimilated. And, and you know, Next Generation and DS9 and every iteration that's come along, even like we were laughing about Enterprise, all of those eventually get swept into the mainstream of Trek. And included, and people retcon their way out of things. They smooth off. That's what I've done in my column in the magazine for my God, now 20 years as of last fall, which is scary to think about.
Yeah.
It's like filling the gaps and smoothing the canon bumps. Right. And, mm-hmm. And that's what we do. So that's going to happen. You're going to have new people thrilled to be working on something. And some people feel beholden to what's gone before and what fans will say. And some folks are saying, no, I'm there, but we can't have it look old. And you get that whole mix. And it's been a story with Discovery. And I think I'm just curious. I'll say this. I'm excited to see what the staff that now has the taxi. It's like we started in a taxi that had three drivers and the car never stopped in a way. But now we got there in good shape, and people actually somehow managed to enjoy the ride along the way and the scenery. But I'm really interested to get in the taxi with the same driver from the beginning of the ride on, and to see another torch metaphor would be to see what this group is going to do with the house they built from scratch rather than the house they went in and kind of kept tweaking and remodeling that they moved into. So I'm excited to see what they do for season two. I think people, you know, there were so many issues with Discovery. One of them, and some of them had nothing to do with the show or canon. One was it's on streaming, so people were upset about All Access. One was it's on streaming and it's serialized. and people, even if they intellectually, you know, watched Game of Thrones or Walking Dead or whatever hot show is, they didn't get how that would be different from Star Trek of 50 years of the last 50 years. And they go, oh, no, I saw this. I saw the serial episodes on DS9, the Dominion War. Well, you know, six or seven is not the same as the entire 15 chapter, you know, the chapters, not episodes of a book. Yeah. Of character, you know, and DS9, you got to know those characters for several years. This is like meeting the characters and getting used to the storytelling format and the new look, and you're paying for it, especially, you know, or right. whatever. So there were just a lot of hoops for people to jump through. I enjoyed the story. I've gotten to talk to some of the writers. I know so many of them are huge fanboys and fangirls, and I'm excited to see what they do for the second year. Part of what I regretted about the serialized shows was how people would focus every week. It was great for the clicks online and for the buzz in the air, but people would get all excited about, you know, the F-bomb or this week, and then a week later it's like, no, they're not going to cuss up a storm every week, you know. It's like the crisis of the moment, headline of the moment, sucked up a lot of the oxygen. So I'm excited now to sit back and watch the whole season as it settles and see what people are taking away. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, big ticket things to take away, like the representation, the diversity, and the casting.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But like the memes and things, and I thought the most powerful thing, maybe the most I was like, whoa, of the whole 15 episode season was an otherwise softcore show, and I'm going blank on the episode name, where you find out that the whole Sarek Spock dynamic was colored by the fact that he didn't give her a boost because he was saving Spock, and then Spock turned him down. And oh my God, that makes why Sarek didn't talk to him for 18 years.
Yeah, you realize, well, everything that Sarek did, it made no difference because Spock passed on it anyway.
Right, but I mean, it's like, it's why Sarek was so bitter and turned on
him. Yeah, yeah.
Because he was embittered by the fact that he sacrificed Michael for a Spock slot, and then Spock didn't go. So he could have, you know, if I could turn back time, I would go back and, let's see, and give it to her.
Singing that in his dream sequence.
So, you know, bring out the Orbitime.
Fool me twice, shame on me.
Stellar slingshot out there. Which I remember thinking, whoa, that may have been the most like deep dive, deep cut moment of the whole. I had been tipped off about the Enterprise popping up at the end, that you wouldn't go aboard, but you'd see it. And then right before, I'd been tipped off that, oh my God, you're going to hate the look of it. So I was like, oh, that's not so bad. Okay.
No, I liked it.
I thought it was great. I of course love the original iteration of it, but I thought it fit in. I was like, that actually looks pretty cool.
Yeah. I'll fly it. I still wince a little bit about the touch screens and the hull of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm not alone. And, you know, blow up the show over that. I said I had a little headcanon going on that in like 2 years later, they find out that touch screens and hull of yours cause cancer. So they have to go back to
scrap it.
So they have to, maybe there'll be something. But
we were kind of playing the same thing with the Spore Drive. It's like, whatever happened to that? Oh, must have been fatal or something.
Well, things like, you know, the Klingons, I kind of go, but then I go, you know what? Species diversity. And when they came out and said there's 24 houses and they didn't all rise up on Kronos, it's like, okay, I can do that. And right now these guys are dominant. Although the whole point was supposed to be there were a bunch of little nomadic units, nobody was in charge. And these are the guys that are coming, you know, T'Kuvma, and these guys are coming to the fore. And I think the longer the show goes, you know, Next Generation started off for its own identity and its own sanity, saying, do not lean on Klingons, Romulans, Vulcans.
Yeah.
Right? Do not lean on transporter stories. Transporter will not break down anymore. We cannot do these original. We have to be on our own, have our own identity. And then when they got secure in their own skin, and then, you know, then Worf was a big revelation because they used Worf to show that time had passed. He became a touchstone of the show to remind everybody visually that this was not Kirk's time.
He was an exception.
Yeah. Well, that was talk about getting into your comfort zone. Yeah.
He let his hair down. That's right.
Yeah. that middle link thing that they were calling the Donald Reed look for a couple of years before it went totally down. When it was all like, you go into a Klingon hairdresser and have the curl put in at the bottom.
Yeah.
But, you know, but then they, by the end of the year, they were bringing in the neutral zone and the Romulans. It was really to set up the Borg later on. But they start relaxing and doing that. And they finally did a Worf Klingon show, you know, Heart of Glory. So, but that's where you start from. And that's where Discovery was with a lot of these things. And so maybe some of that will relax and they'll hit their groove and they'll experiment and they'll find a way to, like I say, there's a difference between design and cinematography. And, you know, but they had such a chaotic start and such a delayed start. They were so under the gun. You know, and kudos to all of that whole staff for landing the show as well as they did. And I always reserve my right to critique. I mean, yes, the Klingon War did end rather suddenly, but then, you know, so did the Dominion War. TV wars tend to wrap up a lot faster than they got started.
Convenient.
It is. So no, I know there's a lot of good people working on Discovery, so that helps me temper how it is. And there have been a lot of cool, fun things done. And I still reserve the right to have canon issues. But I also kind of know in the back of my mind, eventually, all will be explained or all will be retconned.
Hopefully.
the singularity will come to pass.
In terms of Star Trek series, I think of all the first seasons, this one got its legs quicker and I enjoyed that much better.
Yeah. Well, I think part of that's like it's a 15 episode modern streaming, you know, BBC/HBO type season. And that's just where the thinking is. But at the same time, you know how people also say, well, the old series never got good till the third season.
Yeah.
I feel like we may have seen a compression. I talk about streaming years or streaming time. I almost feel like we've gone through the equivalent of 3 years of a normal series. You know, the old school series in this.
I can see that.
The first few episodes. And that, I mean, we talked, you know, the prologue was written a certain group of people. The next three or four shows kind of came with the shows, the staffs eventually overlapping. And then the last six or eight or so, not six or eight, the last six or so were the eventual writing staff. And there were even some changeovers on the production side, too, a little bit. So evolutions. And some things were – a lot of people came on just for the pilot, meaning the first two, and they were only doing the pilot to establish the look and then leaving. So some of that was planned. Mm-hmm. But there was just much flux getting a story. But a Star Trek, again, Next Gen, the J.J. movies, when they tried to start everything over again with Enterprise and, you know, have fresh blood, the movies in the 80s, it's really – Star Trek is so many moving parts to live up to what people expect out of it that it's hard to start that up from zero.
Mm-hmm. And different people have different expectations. Yeah. So it's not even like one target you're trying to hit.
Yeah. Like for me, I think Star Trek works best on a TV serialized format rather than the big movies because, as you've seen with the J.J. movies, they're more action than – hey, you know, put your brain to work.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And you can't really focus on characters like, you know, obviously, especially TNG. There has been Worf episodes. There's been Data episodes. There's been Picard, you know, and they can mix it up, you know.
Even but there's Deanna. Never been an episode about Bailey except for Corba.
The Wrath of Bailey. You have to bring that up.
Is this a running sore spot with you,
Chuck? it's a sketch we came up with on our other podcast, Technorama. I said, you know, I was watching Corbomite Maneuver one day, and I realized they just left Bailey with Baylock. They just left him there. So I came up with this sketch called The Wrath of Bailey. It's just, you know, he was there for like 40 years drinking Tranya. God, at least someone came back to check on Khan. I've been stuck here with this little bald kid.
It's not so bad. He has like a big brother that's a big director, and they had this big bear for a while, and then
You can see he eventually moved to Cronus
for a while, and
he moved to Cronus.
And on that note,
I just see him finding him later, 15 years later, and having Bailey go, "This is the Fasarius pod ship."
On that note,
Hey, wait a minute. Before you go, I got a question for you. Are you ready to wrap up, Chuck?
If you've got one more question, okay. We'll take it.
Okay. So the one question, besides Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, if you had to nail down one of your favorite characters out of all of Trekdom, who would you call? Who would be your favorite?
Oh my gosh! Why do you do that? Like the sentimental show, like the one you were with the longest is a sentimental easy answer. A favorite.
Well, I've got my answer. I want to see what's yours.
What's yours?
It's actually a toss up between Worf and Nog.
Hmm.
I like Nog's story arc, but I like Worf overall.
Yeah. And they both definitely had one and from kind of the same roots. Mm-hmm. Wow. Cause you're going to say like, you know, there's 47 characters on DS9. It's hard. Yeah. Favorite character beyond the original series. Oh, it's Ensign Dawson Walking Bear from the animated. No, I'm kidding.
I like this place. It's got variety.
It's the five and dime of fun places. Wow, that's not fair.
That's not a real fair
question.
That's not fair. I've always had a soft spot for Q. And just his hijinks.
Yeah.
But then you find out there's much more to him than just this arrogant guy.
And you know, and so part of this is like with the after Next Gen, DS9 had a couple years down before we moved out of here. But from the middle of DS9 on, I saw Voyager and Enterprise birthed here. So it's like I have a hard time. Sometimes I'll stop and filter out the actor person from the character. And they've had great success with casting and wonderful people and talented people and all that. And a lot of them are just really nice, good-hearted people too. And I'm not talking about like I party with people constantly, but a handful I do see more often than not. And at conventions, it's very easy to go back or talk or do a project or do an interview with somebody. And that colors, and it's like, no, you're thinking of the person, not the character. So oh my God. And I try to get into a thing about being fair to all the kids, or excuse me, all the franchises, all the iterations.
Yeah. Like, I was just thinking the same thing because
it's like finding a favorite. If I name one character, that means I must prefer that show over the other ones. And yeah. I like them for different reasons. Like you might like your kids for different.
Well, and it's also important to remember recency factor. It's like, Saru is rapidly rising up the charts as one of my favorite characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. He was great.
Well, I can't say it's not like past tense. It's like I want to see what they do with him.
Yeah.
Yes.
I want to see what they do with the poor Silent Bridge crew. But they went to so much trouble to give them all full names and
exactly
and show them off.
Not just shaved head lady.
Hey, Memory Alpha's got a background on a lot of them.
Well, the show has come up with, and David Mack put background into his, you know, his first novel. David helped the show. They mutually came up with some of that stuff in the secret days of the show. Oh, wow. This is so scary. It's like if I had a favorite character, it would probably come from
Wesley,
Next Generation or DS9. And I almost leaned toward DS9, partly because they had such a deep bench of characters. And so many of those guys and gals are such good guys and gals.
I see where you're going with this. Rom is your
Mourn. Mark is actually a very nice guy, by the way. You know, Mark Shepard. Mark Allen Shepard. Wow. Not fair. I call foul.
Okay, fair enough.
If this was a live show, I would have like wasted half the hour and ratings plummeted and I'd still be booed.
Get out the action figures.
Yeah. Even to say, go through all the shows and come up with your, because there is no other character kind of like McCoy on the other shows. I like that character. I like McCoy because he was when I say anti-hero, I don't mean an anti-hero like Clint Eastwood's unknown, you know, the Drifter in the spaghetti westerns. I mean anti-hero as in everybody else is out being heroic, you know, like Spock and Kirk.
Yeah.
And McCoy was like, oh, get over yourselves. We're just here doing our jobs. You know, yeah, I saved your butt a few times. Don't forget that either. You know,
by the way, I'm a doctor, not a insert your Insert your favorite career meme here.
I'm a doctor, not an intentional action figure, you know, or whatever. So I wasn't born posing, you know. So I'm racing through the DS9 characters. I don't know. I like, but again, I love Garrick, but then I love Andy Robinson. I like Phlox.
Yeah.
But I love John Billingsley. And I don't mean I don't like other ones. I just especially have, you know.
Actually, I really found after going back and rewatching DS9, I really found myself enjoying the Ferengi a lot more because they were actually fleshed out a little bit more than they were when we saw Jin. And it was like, oh, okay. And Quark turned out not to be so, you know, he's got a soft spot and everybody's, you know.
The Grand Nagus. Grand Nagus was
Quark!
Quark! Quark! What are you hiding back there, Quark? Yeah. I just wanted the Grand Nagus just once to say, inconceivable!
I know. I kept going, he's got to say that.
We all wanted that.
How did that not happen?
That must have been a trademark thing or something.
I don't know. Wally, it worked. Yeah. Right. Maybe Wally Shawn was just allergic to it, but he asked to say it, so...
Quark, if you poison my drink, then I know you gave me the poison, and that means you have the poison.
Quark, Grand Nagus, give us a piece of your advice. Never get involved in a land war on Cardassia Prime. No.
I always leave him laughing.
I hope we woke up the people that snoozed off at the first part of the show. Yeah.
Join us for episode 84 of Larry Nemechek.
We'll settle it. Vic Fontaine is your favorite, and just call that.
Oh, well, I wouldn't mind that. Okay.
Hey.
I'll go with that, yeah.
Wait a minute. Okay, now, is it the Prime or the Mirror?
Stop.
Vic Fontaine.
Knew that was coming. Larry, where can listeners find out more about you?
Well, apparently another 2 hours of this show. No.
In the next hour.
LarryNemechek.com is kind of your first best place. And you can Portal 47 and the Con of Wrath all have pages, portal47.net especially. But that's that. And my main Facebook page is Larry Nemechek's Trekland, which is also my Instagram handle. And then I'm just at Larry Nemechek on Twitter, and my YouTube channel is just Larry Nemechek. So that's all good stuff.
Outstanding. Now
the Trek Files is The Trek Files on Facebook. It's all at Facebook. You can subscribe at podcast.roddenberry.com. But you can get everything, the episode and the document scanned and the commentaries, you know, where people message and talk, is all at the home base on Facebook.
Terrific. Thank you. I look forward to hearing more.
Thanks, guys, and trek well.
If you like the show, please be sure to tell a friend about it and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. We'd love to hear from you. Follow us on Twitter at The Topic is Trek, visit our Facebook page, or visit thetopicistrek.com. Until next time, on behalf of Craig, Clinton, and myself, I'm Chuck Tomasi, thanking you for listening. And as always, as we say here on The Topic is Trek, don't put on the red shirt! Beam me up, Scotty.